Hi, I'm Jonathan Monti. I recently interviewed Billy Corgan on Friday the 13th, 2012. We talked about the process of the reissues, the new Lucky 13 project, and about the new album Oceania. I hope you enjoy this hour-long interview. So I understand you're working in the Melancholy reissue right now. Can you tell us kind of like what's the process from starting a reissue to the final product that ends up in my hand? What are some of the steps?
I think the first thing you have to do is sort of target what kind of audience you're trying to reach. And I think when it comes to the reissues, you have to take a balanced approach. On one end, you have to consider fans who probably have maybe everything or a lot of stuff, and even in some cases bootlegs. You have to take into account, well, what do we have that's not available, or how can we present things in a new light? At the same time, you have to consider the mainstream fan, or let's say the young fan who's coming in for the first time, that they get a chance to sort of feel some part of the Pumpkins world in a way that makes sense, so it's not just like, you know, some obscurity that, like, you know, a hardcore fan would love, but the new fan or the young fan doesn't really understand contextually. I would say it's ultimately about context. So it's trying to find a balanced view of the obscure, but in a way that doesn't necessarily turn people off, because there's plenty of obscure things. But, you know, me singing Muzzle with a half-assed lyrics in a different arrangement, which might be appealing to somebody who loves that song, if you're, say, a new fan, you'd be like, why is this on here? So it's quality versus context, I think, is the question that you're getting at. So in terms of an actual process, I have to spend a lot of time sort of assessing everything that's there. And then once I assess everything that's there and available, then kind of whittling it down to how does this stuff all fit together. And so it's an interesting listening experience in and of itself. Because as a fan of other bands and other artists, I don't like it when I can't listen to the, let's call it the B-disc of a famous record or something, and it doesn't, in and of itself, it's not an interesting listening experience. And so far I've been satisfied, and I know Pisces hasn't come out yet. I think between Gish, Siamese, and Pisces, you can listen to those discs, and they kind of make sense in and of themselves. Like, they have their own feeling, and I think that's really, really important.
And once you find these materials, the songs, what process do they have to go through?
First of all, you have to kind of decide whether or not you're going to remix something or you're going to keep the original version. So I'll give you a perfect example. Like, Soothe, which is the first song on Pisces, the Scary at the actual release, that was from a home demo that I mixed probably straight into a DAT machine without any real good equipment. So we've done a fresh mix of Soothe for Pisces. That's the only song on Pisces that has a new mix to it, because we thought we could upgrade the fidelity of it. But in the case of something like, let's say, Frail and Bedazzled, you know, we're trying to find the original mix, which, you know, is not as simple as it sounds, because between lack of documentation, bad memories, misplaced things, you know, you might hear something and say, is that the mix? No, maybe that's not. You'll find something that's a rough mix, and you're like, wait a second, that's not the mix. Wait, this is the mix. And there's a lot of detective work that goes on because of, honestly, mislabeling is probably the best way to say it. A lot of things aren't properly labeled because they were, you know, at the time you didn't have to have the proper label, because you're like, okay, that's the stuff that we need. You'd send it to New York, how we would remaster it, which is the final step in preparing it for official release. And then it would come back and it would go in a box somewhere, you know. So 15 years later, you're trying to say, is that the right DAT? Is that the right cassette? And it can be very dizzying, and luckily my memory's pretty good.
How long do you think this entire process takes, typically, to do just one reissue?
It's really hard to quantify, because we have people working around the clock who are transferring the materials into the digital format so that they can easily be accessed. And then, like, over the past 2 days, I've spent 8 hours, and I've gone through stuff before. This is, like, say, like a second round. Now, in the last 2 days, over 8 hours plus, I went through every Melancholy home demo, some rehearsal materials, every rough mix that was generated during the Melancholy session. So that's a lot of stuff. I mean, you consider we worked on the album for somewhere in 8 to 10 month range. That's a lot of materials. So to be able to digitally go through it quickly and just click on a button and go to the next thing and not have to wait, fast forward, rewind, and have all the materials easily listed, or look up a matrix number and say, hey, can you play this version of Knuckles? And then I play the version of Knuckles and I say, oh, that's my home demo version. No, I need the Flood recorded studio version, blah, blah, blah. That it's the ability to kind of knock around in the three-dimensional digital world quickly to access the materials. That's key. So when I say like even 8 hours, that doesn't account for all the time it took to digitally transfer the materials and then have an engineer kind of put all the materials into a pile. Mm-hmm. So the 8 hours is actually probably just the listening time against all the time it took to organize the material.
And then properly name those files according to what they actually are.
Adam. Right, and there's a lot of stuff mislabeled or maybe has a working title. So, like, for example, the working title of XYE was Spum. Here's a perfect example. We recorded XYU live in the studio. Flood and Alan were there. And so what you hear that came out of Melancholy is a live version. There's no overdubs on it. It's strictly just the band playing live in the studio. Well, we did multiple versions. So in preparing the reissue, I said to Bjorn Thorsrud, who people recognize, been around working with me since the Adore era, can you go locate the original 24-track masters of that thing? So he has to go look, and he of course, puts in the database XYU. Well, of course, in the boxes, it says Spum. Okay, so he locates those. Now we have to actually transfer the 24-track analog tapes to the digital format so we can listen to them, see if they're even worthy of release. Let's say take two of Spum / XYU. I think, oh, that's pretty interesting. That's a slightly different version than the one that came out. I think that's worthy of the reissue. Now we have to have somebody remix it. So let's say I say to Bjorn, okay, you're going to please remix version 2. He remixes version 2. Then I have to approve the mix. Let's say I approve the mix, then you have to still send the mix out to be mastered to prepare it for release. So you see it's a very... So every piece of material, depending on its problem, I mean, depending on its source and its result, has a different thing. In the case of another song, I may decide, well, I like that mix. We have to actually find the actual original mix to source from. So on Airplane Flies High, let's say Cherry, we have to locate the actual mix of Cherry, you know, where there might be six mixes or rough mixes or working mixes. So there's a lot of time spent to figure out what the actual mix is, and then that has to be sent out to be mastered. So it's a very complex process because it's not just one set of problems. Every song is its own problem. And we just found the tape to today, but we had a missing reel from the Melancholy stuff. So we spent 3 days trying to locate the missing reel, which had been mislabeled as 1998 instead of 1995, meaning the year. Yeah. So for 3 days, we thought we had a reel with no Tales of a Scorched Earth. Now, part of the reason I'm looking for Tales of a Scorched Earth is, through the years, many people have said, is there a non-distorted mix? Because as some people would know, I distorted the mix at the very end because I felt like it at that moment because we'd been up for 86 days redoing the album, and that's a decision I made at the last second. I'm interested to hear if there's a non-distorted mix of Tales of a Scorched Earth. If there is, maybe we'll release that as an extra track. We actually have to locate the distorted mix for the Melancholy reissue. And then also, if let's say there isn't a non-distorted mix, maybe we'll remix it and put out a non-distorted mix, but then we'd have to find the original 24-track. And then have that transferred, and then Bjorn have to mix it. And so you see, it's every song has its own like question mark next to it. Like, what do we want to do? I feel some people can appreciate this. Outside of changing the finished mix of Space Boy, I just chose a different mix one as opposed to whatever mix four. Every song so far in Gish, Siamese, and Pisces, except for where we've remixed Soothe, is the original mix because I want to stick in essence to the original mixes on the album. But in the case of like Starla, which was a mix which was done staying up all night, I thought it would be interesting to have Carrie do a fresh mix with fresh ears in a different era. And so he did a different take on the song, which I think is interesting. It's like looking at a picture from a different angle or something. So you have the original version vision of the album, but you still give fans the opportunity in certain cases to hear a song in a different light.
So today, the announcement of the Lucky 13 was announced to fans. And
lucky you.
Yeah, lucky me. So a lot of fans are asking, of course, a couple of questions, and one that I constantly see, and everybody's always asking, why not release everything?
And I think that they would best respect your answer of why not release everything.
Well, there's a couple different answers to that, and I'll try to answer that from a couple different perspectives. Number one, when people say everything, I don't think they realize how much material there actually is. I don't know if you could quantify it into hours, but let's say we could use everything in a very general term. Let's say everything I have in digital form right now I could release. Let's say it's 1,000 hours worth of stuff. Okay, the band has sat and paid for, and this includes, you know, James, Darcy, and Jimmy. We have sat on this material for over 10 years, and we pay approximately $30,000 to $40,000 a year in media storage costs to keep the materials at the correct temperature, so that they don't degrade. So that's a technical issue. So the band's somewhere between $400,000 to $500,000 invested in just keeping the materials in a state where they can be used. Now we've spent another couple $100,000. I don't know. It could be $300,000 for all I know, transferring the materials into a more stable digital form. So let's say the band's total investment, including my own investment, is somewhere in the range of $750,000. Okay, so if I just dump all this stuff out in the open market, what do we charge? Who's going to put it into any form? Do we want everything the band ever put out, no matter how awful, me singing out of tune, you know, us having an argument between two songs about somebody hitting the wrong note? I mean, what does everything mean? Now let's take it from another angle. Let's say I had the time, or somebody had the time, which is kind of what we're trying to do with Lucky 13. Let's say you and a group of people had the time to actually go through quote-unquote everything and whittle it down to a bunch of stuff that you thought would be a fan base would want to hear. And let's say it's 1,000 things. And 1,000 things could be a rehearsal version of Muzzle, an alternate version of Stumbling, whatever. Let's just say you decided there were 1,000 individual pieces of things that people might want to hear. And let's say it's not live stuff, just studio-related moments, like a rough mix of 1979. Everyone can use their imagination what that would be. Okay, who's going to price that? How can the band be certain it's going to get, let's even to the point where the band is at zero for the investment that it's made. I mean, we're not running a charity here. We're running a business where we want to continue to be able to put out music in an interesting way. So that whole idea of everything is like what? So we dump it on the open market and everybody gets to pick through it. The band doesn't get to get repaid for the investment that it's made to keep the materials prepared. And then what? Somebody's going to put on YouTube a clip of me singing horribly on something, and then there's going to be 52,000 listens of, like, my God, what an awful singer. I mean, there's different ways we have to look at these materials. You know, for every great gem that somebody might find in a two-hour tape, there might be just as 10 times more things that are kind of substandard. I mean, if your favorite movie is Wizard of Oz and you found out there was 40 hours of additional footage of making Wizard of Oz, is somebody going to sit there and want to pay and watch all 40 hours? No, I think you need somebody to kind of whittle that down and say, here's the most interesting of the 2 hours. Are there 50,000 people out there who want to pay $5,000 for everything or $1,000 for everything? I don't think there's any model by which everything makes sense. Let's say it wasn't even a money thing. Let's say money wasn't even part of it. I don't think I want everything sitting out there. I don't think that's part of my artistic legacy to have somebody hear every time I burp into a microphone. I don't think that's befitting either. And we didn't work in a form like, let's say, the Beatles worked, where, you know, there's very little audio of the Beatles working in a studio. Most of it is from the Let It Be sessions where they were being filmed. Well, the Beatles were used to working and rehearsing as a band that would play their songs all the way through. We didn't necessarily work that way. We did a lot of jamming, a lot of experimenting. A lot of times songs would go without lyrics, and I would do what I call blah blah lyrics, where, and I heard some of this stuff today. I heard some version of I don't know what song was it, Tales of a Scorched Earth, or one of these songs where I was just kind of making up lyrics on the fly with totally different melodies. And, you know, yeah, I didn't mind doing that in front of my band or in front of my producer. But I never in a million years thought that I would want somebody out there to hear that and then judge the band on it or judge me on it in a way that's like, what the fuck is this? Because there's no way to create that context if you put everything out. So there has to be some form of filter. That's my point. So I think that's a completely unrealistic question. I don't mind answering the question, but I think that's a completely unrealistic question. I think everything assumes that everything's worth listening to, and it isn't. I would say if we have, let's say we have 1,000 hours of stuff that could come out, I would say maybe only 10% or 20% is even worth listening to. The rest of it is very repetitive. I mean, do people want to hear 9 different rehearsal versions of us working on Tales of a Scorched Earth? I don't think so. I just don't see where that's relevant. So I think that's a really naive question.
Some of the fans have been wondering, in our Lucky 13 press release, we say that the fan input is essential to the Lucky 13 project being successful and getting to where we want it to go. Why would you think that the fans' input is essential at all? Why not just pick things out on your own?
First of all, I don't think I have the time to do it because, as most people know, I spend most of my time working on new projects. Right now I'm writing a book, and we're preparing for the release of Oceania, so I'm actually eating to what would normally be my free time to work on the Melancholy reissues. You know, so like I said, I've spent 8 hours over the past 2 days. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of time, but that's like time I normally don't have even for myself. And, of course, then there's a lot of associated energy that needs to, you know, I had to say, okay, you mix this and do this. It's not as simple as me just doing 8 hours and I walk away. That begets a whole other round of work that's going to come later. It's so hard to explain. I think what needs to happen, and I talked about this when I talked with Brian Solis at South by Southwest, I think the fan, if we even want to use that word anymore, I think that's in a way an inappropriate word. Let's call it an engaged consumer. If an engaged consumer wants to be a part of the creative process of helping create the situation by which more music can be available, be heard. So, for example, if you're a big Siamese Dream fan and you actually want the 4 to 6 hours of Siamese Dream Death to come out, I think that's fairly realistic. But they still need to be prepared. They still need to be edited down at some level so that if somebody decides to pay, let's say, $20 for 6 hours of Siamese Dream material or $40 or whatever the price would be, that person still needs to feel like they're getting their money's worth. And so we have to set up a system where an intelligent part of the fan community, the engaged consumer community, would engage in essence with the Lucky 13 group to try to figure out what's a fair pricing model so that everybody gets what they want and we get back what we want. And what we want as a group, as a collective mentality, and where people get really lost in, it's not a money equation. It's like an energy versus energy. I can't spend 1,000 hours digging out 4 nuggets out of the archives to then have somebody, only 67 people want it. There has to be some sort of system by which people who are in a really invested group say, yes, we think this is something that everybody needs to hear, and then integrate with the community to decide, okay, let's say there's 4 hours of a Siamese Dream working death. Okay, what's a fair pricing model? I want everybody to feel invested so that they can continue to be a part of this process. Because once we get, let's say we get through the studio layer, then there's a live layer. There's tons of live stuff that I'd like to have come out, you know? So does everybody want, like, I don't know how many concerts we have from Siamese Dream era. We don't have as many as I would like. Let's say there's 20 concerts on tape, all with varying degrees of audio quality because they're board tapes. Some are good, some are so-so. Does that everybody want everything? Okay, like the question, why can't we put out everything? Well, if you get back or we get back as a community, yes, we want to hear everything. Well, then pricing models need to be established. What are the pricing models? Are they, we're going to press up 500 vinyl of every soundboard concert in the Siamese Dream era, and if we make a certain amount on the vinyl part of it, then we can offer everybody maybe the vinyl people pay a little bit higher price, but once we know that the project is a break-even project, then everybody else has it available digitally for an even lower price. Is that how the model works? Or does everybody who buys in want a vinyl copy because they want a hard copy? Those are all things that the community needs to figure out for themselves. I don't have time to be that guy, nor do I want to be in the political position of having to try to sell somebody something because I'm out of that business. And I think that that's the change. I think the old business model asked people like me to be salespeople, and I think people like me are always uncomfortable with that position. I mean, look, the sales job is, I've invested all this time and energy to make this music. I really want you to listen. What else do I need to say? But in the modern world that I grew up in, you know, you have to give the interview, and you have to, you know, have to talk about your dead mommy, and you have to cry when you talk about your old band. There has to be all this other shit to get somebody to buy a record. I no longer believe that's possible. And on top of that, all that stuff isn't getting people to buy records. So if they're going to buy something, they have to really feel that they're getting what they're putting up. And I've said it a million times. If a million people wanted to buy, let's say quote unquote everything for a dollar, then great. But if only 5,000 people want to buy it, a dollar's not realistic. So the pricing models, just like they are at Target or Walmart, are set by the demand. And I think that that's a completely mature way to look at it. So I think Lucky 13 can work with the community to establish what is worthy of release. If at the end of the day everybody says everything, let's say you come back in 3 months and say, hey, everybody wants everything. Well, then you're going to have to figure out, they're going to have to figure out what everything is worth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, for me, you know, because we've had so many of these conversations, one of my things that always comes to mind is that I understand that A, money needs to be made back to be able to afford all the money that's been put into it. You have to at least break even. And it has to be something that you would want for to actually be out there. Like you said, you don't want every burp that you make in a microphone out there. But
I think it can come off like the way you're saying it, and I'm not arguing with you. Mm-hmm. But I think it can come off a little bit like a black and white argument. I would say it to you like this. The question is not the horrible stuff, because that's just never going to come out. And the question is not the great stuff, because most of that's already out. It's the gray area in between. Let's say, for example, and I think everybody can understand, let's say I've got a Siamese Dream era taped soundboard concert, and the band's performance is pretty good, not great and not horrible, and, you know, let's say we just had a good night. But the sound quality, for whatever reason, is a 5 out of 10. Like, if you're a fan of Soma, I mean, you can hear that it's Soma, and maybe the guitar solo is too loud and the bass is too low, and maybe the vocals come in and out a little bit, but if you're a fan, you would like it as something that you would want to own, then I think you need to go to the community and say, this is the quality level, is this something you want? And I think there's ways to ascertain whether that's something 100 people want. Now, if 100 people want that, and I'm really flexible, I want it to everyone to understand, that would hear this, that I am flexible. So if you came back to me and said, okay, 100 people want it, but in our polls and in our dialogue, 100 people say, yes, I want that, even that concert that's a 5 out of 10, because I'm a huge Siamese Dream fan, and I want those songs, and I don't mind having that so-so version, because if I was in, you know, like I've been to Japan many times, well, bootlegs in Japan cost anywhere from $30 to $40. Okay, well, if it was $30 to $40 in a store, if I can get it straight from SPRC for $25, and maybe I'm willing to pay a little bit more to get it with a T-shirt or some other way to price it so everybody feels really good about it as a commercial thing, well, maybe there's a way to do it where it's like you get a limited edition T-shirt and you get this kind of 5 out of 10 concert on vinyl, and everyone, you get mailed to a digital download, so you don't have to worry about that. And then you know that once you kind of engage that and the band decides, or I decide to put it out, then you also know you're helping the rest of the community that can afford it have access to it at a lower price. And yeah. So then maybe you can go around to your friends and say, we need 20 more people to say they want to do this, and once they hit this mark of, say, 100 or 200 or whatever the Kickstarter-type model would be, then you know you get to get a copy that's an immediate collector's item, and if you listen to it and you're like, yeah, it's okay, you know you could put it on eBay tomorrow and you could make your money back. I think that's the modern, mature way of looking at it. The consumer can be empowered to engage me as the artist to give you what you want. I'm sitting on these materials, and I'm more than willing to put them out as long as they're not terrible. But at the same time, I can't slap something out there and say, Pumpkins, 93, blah, 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 and then you call me up a week later and go, oh, everyone's really mad because you charge too much and the sound quality isn't good. That's the old way of doing it. You know, wink, wink, try not to notice that this is inferior. I think the new way to do it is say, this is what we have, because these things weren't made to be released. They were for private collections, or we would tape a show because the sound guy wanted to hear whether he or not he was doing a good mix. If we were thinking like this in 1993, we would have taped everything. Now, I started thinking like this in 1995, as some people know, and we actually started recording every concert on what the format was at the time, which was ADAT. So we have ADAT multi-tracks of basically every Melancholy concert on, and then the format's changed. So, you know, I know we're not talking about, like, Billy Corgan's solo tour Future Embrace, but like I have every solo Embrace show taped on Pro Tools. So whatever, there were 30, 40 future embrace shows, I have every show on Pro Tools. And so when we get around to reissuing Future Embrace someday, maybe we decide to only put out one, like a best collection of the live stuff, and then there's a single tour and it's a single release. Or we decide to make a model where you could just get the Pro Tools files and mix it yourself.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, you understand this is all flexible thinking, and I think that's what the new type of fan in the world can see, is they can actually help create the way they want to do it. But they have to be empowered, and they have to, in essence, and please understand my French, put your money where your mouth is. You can't just sit there and say, I want it. That's really immature. But you can work with your community and say, are there 100 people out here that are willing to pay, you know, let's say $50 for this weird, you know, soundboard release? Or if we get to 500 people, then the price model goes down to $29.95 or something. I think that's a new way to do it, and I think that's a cool way to do it, and then everybody feels good about it. I'm not in the exploitation business, and nothing irks me more, as you know, when I try to talk about these things in public before, of people saying, he only cares about money. Trust me, if I want to make money, it's not in the reissue program. If people knew what Smashing Pumpkins can command as a live band, I mean, one Smashing Pumpkins concert makes 10 times more than I'm going to make on any of this stuff, 100 times more. I'm loath to make it a money equation, but everybody has to understand that at some point it has to be about energy exchange. And right now in music, that is the key energy exchange. Now, if there was another way where I could say, send you this Siamese Dream concert for free and know that you're going to go out and help market Oceania, and there was some system by which, you know, they used to use like, say, Street Team, then maybe there'd be a different way to do it, but that system doesn't exist. So it's just energy. You know, I have to pay employees to transfer the stuff to digital. Once it goes to digital, I have to pay an employee to organize the stuff for me. Once I decide what it is, I have to pay somebody to master it. I mean, these are all costs that are real costs. And then, of course, there's my time. So when people try to make it about money to me, that's why I end up trying to talk about money to them, because I don't think they really understand. When I see a fan going, like when I talked about, I remember, you know, that time we were talking about, you know, trying to do the Ustream or whatever, where people could watch what was the initial writing of Tiergarten. And I think I was asking for $1 a day or $2 a day. And I was literally reading comments from fans saying, all he cares about is money. It's like, I wish you could have seen my face when I was reading that. It's like $2 a day. Like, what do you think? I'm going to like buy another house? I mean, it's just not realistic. And I'm at a point in my life where I don't want to insult fans by trying to play games with words about money. Let's just call it for what it is. And I think there are really cool ways to do this. The whole idea of reaching out to you to help start the Lucky 13 thing was, I think that as a community, you guys and girls can figure out what you think is fair. You know, and maybe you guys can think up a model that I'm not even thinking. You know, maybe it's a bundling model, or maybe it's a model where we offer a lot of materials at once, and then everybody gets to pick. And through the offering of a lot of materials, and everybody gets to cherry pick through the concerts. Like, that's one thing I've thought about with the Rubano tapes. You know, there's roughly, you know, 40 to 60 hours of the Rubano tapes. They're in completely different levels of quality because most of them are recorded with mics. Okay, so my idea would be, I would offer a Rubano box set, and let's say I'd offer it at a premium. I don't know what I would charge. $200, $150, $400, can't say, so don't hold me to it. But I would do the math, and I'd say, okay, if 500 people ordered the box, or 1,000 people ordered the box, or 2,000 people ordered the box, just like Trent Reznor's done, after that, we can offer everybody the chance to pick whatever they want. For the consumer that can only, they only want to spend $5, well, they can listen to clips of every Rubano tape and just pick their 5 favorite songs. And then they can thank the people that bought the box set because they made it possible.
Gotcha. So having maybe a small bunch to be able to make the larger distribution to get a bigger settlement and other people can cherry pick.
That is no different than what record companies do. That is no different than what record companies do. Record companies pay advances to artists like me based on how much they think they're going to sell. After that, then it comes about how we're going to divide the pie once we recoup our money. The old model was, you know, we want to sign Rage Against the Machine so bad, we're going to overpay to sign them. And then if you had a good record company, they wouldn't punish the band. And if you had a bad record company, they would punish the band because they'd overpaid. Just like when they overpay a baseball player and the fans are booing because the guy's not hitting. What I really want to see is, you know, I think, you know, Smashing Pumpkins fans are some of the most intelligent, educated fans in rock. By and large, they're college educated, they're sophisticated, and even if they didn't go to college, they're street smart. They like the band because they've decided they like the band for their own reasons, and it's not a trendy thing. I mean, it's been a long time since the band was a trendy thing. So if you're still a Smashing Pumpkins fan, or you become one, or without any of the politics being part of it, you've decided you really like the legacy of the band's music, or whatever your reasons, most of those people tend to be fairly intelligent people. And I think we can create new models and new systems by which to do this that would be revolutionary. Now, is it revolutionary like it's going to change everything? No, but I think this is a really new way to do business. I think it's actually, you know, as many people know, I'm fairly spiritual. I think this is the spiritual way to do business. Free doesn't exist. I mean, nothing is free. You walk down the sidewalk, somebody paid taxes for it. You know, it's the Beatles saying, you know, if you die, they tax the pennies on your eyes. I mean, everything in life costs something. All we're trying to do is find a cost-release relationship where everybody can feel good. As I've told you in private, if I do something that I feel is too risky and I get burned, for example, I put out the Rabano box, right, and I don't have any way to reassure myself that I'm going to get, you know, back the investment that I put into it, because that, particularly that project, if, for people who don't know, Rabano is, Mike Rabano used to tape all the Pumpkins early shows. So I have Pumpkins rehearsals and pretty much like the first, I don't quote me, but somewhere in the range of the first 30 to 50 Pumpkin shows on tape. And you can literally hear the band develop. And there's shitty songs, and there's cool songs, and there's early versions of songs, basically all the way up through the release of Gish. And he had the first, he was there from when the band played the Avalon. We were just playing with the drum machine. I mean, he's got some, he taped some really cool stuff. And some of it's rough sounding and stuff, but it's, if you're a fan and you really want to dig through, like I am, you want to dig through. Okay, so people have to understand. Let's say I decide, okay, you know, I've spent all this money and now I got to charge $250 to get my money back, and I put that out and I put all the money out for the manufacturer and the guy who develops the art, and then I only sell a third of the copies and the rest are sitting in the warehouse. I'm never going to put anything else out. That's the end of the program. So on the other level, I mean, I know I have a lot of fans that are empathetic and really do understand these kind of concepts. That fan doesn't want me to feel like burned by the process either. They want me engaged and excited and want me to put up the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And for those who have some intimate knowledge, which you're one of those people, you know that the band can put out stuff for the next 20 to 30 years. I mean, I don't know how many melancholy concerts we have. And as many people know, those shows were anywhere from 2.5 to 3 hours generally every night, and a lot of songs were improvised, and even if you like a song like By Starlight, the end would be different every night, and, you know, different things would happen. Well, you know, I don't know how many melancholy concerts I have on tape, but I might have like 120. Now, do we put all 120? Maybe you and fans come back and say, yeah, we want all 120 concerts. Well, let's together figure out a way where that can happen. Maybe in that case, maybe it's a case where a fan says that, you know, them and their seven friends who are all audio engineers, they want the opportunity to mix the concerts. And then we open source the concerts, and they get to mix the concerts, and we're able to do it because a certain number of people sign up and say they want it.
So a Kickstarter, you know, thing is really essential to be able to make sure that a product can actually come out.
Well, there's the, you know, this was part of the problem with the Tear Garden stuff is, you know, I was writing, you know, $100,000 checks to put that stuff out, and I'm not a record company.
Right.
Then I got to go through somebody, and then they're delayed on the checks, and it's like, it gets really complicated. I think that what I like about the Kickstarter model, I think people know exactly sort of what that means at this point, is you set a level, and in this case, we'd want the fans to work with us to set a level. Everybody's enthusiastic about it. You hit that mark you're looking for within the first week, and then boom, everybody gets to participate. And I'm not talking about a closed model. I think the Rabano tapes is a good example. I would like a situation where we decide what that level is, that entry level is. The people who decide to step up and get it, they get something, whether it's an autograph box set. They know they have an instant collector's item. They know they know there's only going to be so many made. So let's say you buy one. You know, you ask your wife for permission. She says it's okay, right?
Right, of course, got to.
Exactly. You get the autograph box set, and you know it's one of a thousand, okay? But you also can turn around and know that you helped make it so that everybody has access to the material. And so if we know in advance going in, okay, we have to sell this many in advance for this to come out, and the moment it hits that number, it will be digitally available at a lower price for this if you still want to buy the whole thing only digitally. And then you'll be able to, and then we'll offer like bundle prices. So for $5, you get to pick 12 songs, and you can go through and listen to audio clips out of, I don't know how many songs it would be. Let's say there's 500 different versions of songs. You can go through and for your, you know, $5, you get to go through and pick the 12 that you want. And then you know that's part of the process. So you're not the fan sitting there on the sidelines going, yeah, well, it's great that Monty can afford the $250 for the box set, but I'm going to have to get a bootleg copy. No, we don't want that. We don't want that person to feel left out. We want that person helping make it a possibility so they know when it comes out, then all the materials will be available. That's what I mean about community. We all have to work together to make this a sustainable model. Everybody knows sustainable green models now, you know, like compost and all this shit that everybody's talking about in the green movement. Okay, well, it's the same thing in the Smashing Pumpkins business. Let's create sustainable models so that I don't feel burned, you don't feel burned. You know, and so when the guy pipes up somewhere on a message board and goes, yeah, all Billy cares about is money, no, then there's five fans who can say, no, actually, that's not true. We've actually set these models. We're working together so that we can continue to be part of a community. That's the new way. Whether or not anybody can see that, that's the new way. Look at, and this is nothing personal, right?
Right.
Nicki Minaj has a new, it's like, her album, I just saw the other, her album, but it's like what they call it, the Reloaded, or, I mean, that, they do that in rap and stuff all the time, where they take the album and then 6 months later they release it with some extra song. I don't want to do any of that stuff. I don't want to do that kind of in what I view as kind of the sneaky way to get the consumer to buy the same thing again. I mean, people were mad about us putting different songs on Zeitgeist with different covers, and let's skip all that from now on. Let's be real transparent. Let's put the stuff up front. And listen, if you work with the fan community and you come back and say, okay, you know, we've done a lot of talking and debating, and everybody feels that this is the fair price model for the Rubano stuff, blah, 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 and I say I can't do it, well, then I can't do it. Right. You know what I mean? Or if I say to you, hey, in order to make this work, I need 1,000 people to buy it at $400, and you go into the fan community and go, you know what, the energy's just not there. Okay, well, then the energy's not there. Maybe we can explore a different opportunity. Maybe there's another way. Or it'll just have to sit until the models change so that 5 years from now we can re-examine it in a different way. And maybe the costs are lower. Maybe the manufacturing costs are lower. Or maybe there's a new way to send you the stuff directly, and because of that, you know you're going to get this high-fidelity file through somebody's new technology and blah, blah, blah. Now maybe you're willing to pay that price and you don't want the CD anymore. The point is to stay flexible, stay open, and stay motivated. And I think the idea with the Lucky 13 is you guys can figure out what it is that you actually want. What's the first thing you said to me via email? You said, everyone's going to say they want the Metro concert, the show from 2000, the last quote-unquote Pumpkin show. It's like, no shit. Okay, I know that, and there's already plans to put that out. Now, I've said that before, but we actually have concrete plans now to put that out. So there's a bit of news for you. And hopefully, under the plan that we do have, it'll be part of this reissue model that we're engaged in now with EMI. So that's not something we have to sell to the fan base.
Gotcha, because it's already taken through the EMI section.
Right, and that goes into their models, and I know what those models are.
Right.
And people can appreciate this, the cost of editing a concert now is far lower because of digital technology than it was 10 years ago.
And if I remember right, was that a big reason why the Metro DVD never made it out originally?
That's a whole complicated thing if people want to have a good laugh.
We always are good for a laugh.
Okay, well, here's a little bit of business that's kind of amusing. And this is EMI, you know, over 10 years ago. The band paid to film the last concert. EMI did. So we, technically, Pumpkins at that time, owned the concert. EMI came when we were putting out the greatest hits in 2001, which we were contractually obligated to do. And they said, we're not sure this is going to sell enough, so can you give us like an extra disc, which ultimately became the Judas O. The great irony was, when they offered Judas O for sale as part of the package. They offered retail stores, the Towers and the Virgin Megastores at the time, they offered them the B-side disc or the package without the B-side disc, and they were very, very surprised that more of the stores ordered with the B disc because Smashing Pumpkins fans wanted the unreleased material. That made sense to me, but the record company was surprised because they thought, oh, people aren't going to want to buy it because it's more expensive, but we want the option. So as part of that, because they didn't want to give us any money for what was essentially a free album because we weren't contractually obligated to give it, I did a deal where I set it up so that we had a system in place where we could release the final concert. Now, knowing how the record company was at the time, I had my lawyer put in a provision which said if they don't release the concert within 2 years of the contract, the band has to be paid a certain amount of money as an exit clause. Basically, in modern terms, they call it like pay to play, meaning if they wanted it, they had to pay, and if they didn't want it, they had to pay. They couldn't walk away from the deal without paying. And after 2 years, they decided not to put the concert out, even though they had the option, even though there was a lot of demand for it, because they were no longer invested in the Pumpkins at that time, because the company had gone a different direction, and they actually paid money to make it go away.
That's that's the epitome of silliness.
Yes. Right. So they basically, it's a little convoluted because in essence, they, if you want to look at it rationally, they did pay for the Judas O album. Yeah, that's the way the deal was set up in a triangle. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. And then of course, lots of other things happened that precluded it coming out. Now is the perfect time, and it's set on the docks to come out. So I feel good about that. And so that's not something we'll have to go to anybody. And I know that people are interested. People ask me all the time, are you ever going to put that out? And I haven't seen it for years, and I'm interested in it coming out. And now we have better technology. There's editing systems are far faster, better quality. You know, we'll be able to offer very high resolution, 5.1 and everything. And so I think it'll be in many ways better than now, if it's going to come out now in the next couple of years, than it would have been back then. So whatever. But we're talking more about the gray area stuff. Right. We're talking about when the Pumpkins were putting out Siamese Dream, we played a concert at the Raymond Review Bar, which was a famous strip bar. I think it was the first strip bar in the world or something. Only held 160 people. And we played a full acoustic show. We have, you know, a full multi-track recording. Does everybody want to hear that concert? If I go to EMI with that, they're like, eh.
So is there going to be a way for fans to be able to see almost what is known available for the catalog so that they could make those selections? Because some people may not even know about that show.
Okay, here's what I would say. The reason I asked you and whoever you're going to put together for the Lucky 13 to start with the known materials is I think that's a way to start putting everybody's heads together on the same page. Mm-hmm. If that shows good, positive progress, and let's call it in quotations a sense of reality, because I don't mean to insult anybody, but saying just put out everything, that's not real. That's just not real. Now, if you come back in 2 months or 3 months and say, okay, we've assessed a lot of this stuff, and we know that there's a pro shot show in, you know, like I remember in...
Double Doors, we know that's a pro shot show.
What's that?
Double Doors is one show that people have been talking about that we know was pro shot.
In terms of video?
In terms of video.
Okay, see, I don't even know that.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so let's say that's true.
Okay.
Because I don't know if that's true, but let's pretend it's true.
All right.
Let's say there's a full Double Doors shot concert. The video exists, and there's a way to mix the audio, or if the audio that exists from the time is worthy of release. Let's say it's not like a horrible piece of shit. Like, I listen to it and watch it and think, oh, it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Okay? Number one, who owns the rights? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like people
MTV.
May think there's a pro shot show, but we find out it was a CNN news group. We don't own those rights. But let's say we own the rights, or let's say somebody else owns the rights. Can we get those rights for a reasonable fee? Not everybody thinks, believe me, you know, we once got sued for over $500,000 for using 40 seconds of footage of me from when I was 18. Not everybody lives in reality where it comes to what they think footage is worth. I got in a lawsuit with a local Chicago videographer who wanted some insane amount of money for some footage that he'd shot. So let's say Larry owns the rights and the Pumpkins don't own the rights. Well, if I go to Larry and say, okay, we want to put this concert out, what are you going to charge? Let's say Larry wants $100,000. There's no way that money's going to come back.
Right.
Because then you're going to have the cost of paying Larry, and then you're going to have the cost of mixing and all that. Let's say Larry goes, yeah, $10,000, or you guys can put it out and give me a piece of the back end or whatever. We've made all these types of deals before. Let's say that's a realistic thing. Now, Lucky 13 would have to go in the community and say, okay, he can actually put this out. It's lined up. His costs aren't going to be too high. How many people out there really want this show? If you come back and say we got 226 responses, I mean,
it might be an expensive show.
Right.
Yeah. And we'll.
It ain't going to happen. That's not realistic. Now, there are situations where maybe, you know, I own the footage or the band owns the footage, and there is footage that I own on my own now that I've been buying up. And I look at it and say, you know, I'm willing to put this footage out for a reasonable price only in a digital format on a, let's say a subscription model is the wrong word. But let's say we had a 1,000 people signed up at a reasonable fee that were willing to watch it digitally because they just want to see it. Okay, well, maybe that works. And then everybody that signs up gets sent a flash drive with the concert on it or something. There's no packaging. There's none of those costs. You know, see, in the normal world, everything has to, you know, you have to deal with the consumer that wants, you know, they want a certain type of picture or a certain type of format, like they want vinyl or they want this. Maybe the fan base comes and say, we're interested in as much material as possible for as low a cost as possible, and we're willing to accept media forms which are cheap.
As opposed to vinyl, like, say, we just want MP3s or flats.
Exactly. Send us the MP3. We're happy with that.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. Maybe the Kickstarter model is a combination model. Maybe we need 500 people to buy the Rubano box set and 5,000 people to sign up for digital copies only. That's what I'm saying. Where people should be excited by this is I'm saying, you guys figure it out, and if you figure it out in a way that I think's fair, everybody's happy. Cool. And then when somebody gets online and starts attacking it, you've got a lot of invested people who are willing to stand up and say, no, that's not right. That's not what's happening here. Cool. When I'm the guy who has to stand there in the middle, and I got a guy writing, I'm not going to buy Oceania because you're a greedy bastard because you charge me too much for the Gish concert. Why do I want to take that risk? I'm very focused in the future. I think it's fair to say, look, if you want me to go into the past, you want me to go to that other level, beyond the reissue, into the subterranean version of what happened, because you really are invested, well, help me make that happen. There have to be, if there's one stupid person out there, 99 fans have to stand up and make the argument of why this is important to them.
And then would there be able to be samples and stuff like that when we get maybe closer to the point of you know, saying...
Yes. Yeah. I think that's part of what you would need to develop. You need to come to me and say, I think I can make this work, but we need to be able to provide a series of clips to kind of push it over the top. I don't think it's fair to ask anybody to buy anything sight unseen. But I don't think... Please understand this. I don't think the sell job is mine. Do you know what I mean? Like, I want the Rubano tapes to come out. I think they're really interesting. There is a lot of music there that nobody's ever heard that's never been bootlegged. There's a lot of music there that no one's ever heard. There's Frank Quinto, who fans know is, you know, is a top Pumpkins fan, works for Pumpkins in the archive department. Frank will come in and he went through a lot of that stuff. He'll come and say, I don't know what song this is. Do you know the title? I mean, when you're talking about a top Pumpkins fan will come in a room and say, I never heard this song. What the fuck song is this? I mean, that's what I'm saying. There are materials, there are performances, there are stuff in there that no one's ever heard. Now, does that mean it's the greatest thing you ever heard? No. But if you're the type of fan who wants to take that journey, you want to see how your favorite band evolved from, like, a Cure-type pub band to, you know, mega rock stardom, well, there's a really interesting journey there that most bands don't have. Now, if you're willing to accept the difference in audio quality, if you're okay with maybe only a digital format and no media, no picture, no liner notes, you don't need the box set, well, then maybe there's... That's what I'm saying. If you come back and say, nobody wants the box set, nobody wants to pay $400 for a box set, then we can sit there and figure out, okay, how many fans do we need that want it in a digital format? How many fans would want it in a digital format where it makes sense? Well, I may come back and say, I need 10,000 fans to do this.
Gotcha. So there'll be, obviously, for people who don't know, there's going to be tons of back and forth between me and you and with the Lucky 13 about what's going to come out. And it's not going to be something that's going to happen tomorrow. It's not like I'm all of a sudden going to have...
No, but stuff can happen fairly quickly. To not give too much away, we have to... Melancholy and Airplane Flies High needs to come out this year. Adore has been pushed back to essentially Record Store Day next year, and I've got a commitment from EMI to also put out a vinyl version of the Stigmata soundtrack, which I think is pretty cool. And then by the end of next year, you would have Machina, and then I don't know if they want a greatest hits or a best of, whether that would come at the end of next year as well. That's not a big deal, average fan, because they'll already have everything, but it's obviously more of a mainstream thing. Okay, well, after that, I get all the rights back for my Warner Brothers materials, which means then the following year, which would be 2014, I could start putting out all the Zwan stuff. And there's, you know, essentially I think there's 65 unreleased Zwan songs. So you can see I want these models to work. So let's say if Zwan and Spun and the unreleased acoustic materials that I made, the Chicago Kid stuff, come out in 2014. By 2015, you're looking at Future Embrace and possibly an alternate version of Zeitgeist. I think in that window from today, which is 2012, to 2015, the main stuff needs to be on its way out. So we're talking about a window of essentially like 3 to 4 years where I think most of the key materials need to come out. I'm not talking about like 10 years from now. I'm talking like, if you want this stuff, step up, make it known you want it to come out. So that's what I'm saying. I think if you guys can establish a relationship and a respect level amongst each other that will demonstrate to me that this is going to be a mature conversation, then as you and I talked in private, I'd be willing to release into the public domain the EMI archive list and the personal Pumpkins archive list, and then you guys can sit there and debate about that stuff.
So go with stuff we know first and then move on to that when we come to that bridge.
The thing about those materials, let's say Pro Shot, let's use Zeitgeist as an example because it's more recent in my memory. I know that, you know, we were shot live in Mexico. I know that we were shot live at Rock and Ring. I know there's complete shows that exist. So let's say out of 10 Pro Shot shows on Zeitgeist, you guys come back and say, we'd really like to see official releases of these two concerts. Is it possible that they could come out high def, Blu-ray, 5.1? You know, you got to come back and kind of give me that information. Those kind of materials are not as difficult to turn around because we know where those materials are. If you come back and say, we want every version of Here Is No Why, that's a much more labor-intensive journey because you're talking about different media. The materials need to be gone through. You need to find out whether or not to get the right versions. They still have to be mastered and in some cases mixed. It's much more time-intensive. Known materials tend to be kind of put together.
To switch gears from the archives, do you mind if we talk a little bit about the Oceania release, about
sure.
future Pumpkins?
Yeah.
A lot of people, of course, are asking about if there will be an Oceania single that will come out, but I wasn't sure because it kind of sounded like you see the old models as going out the door, and I was wondering if there's going to be anything like that where there might be a single.
The current plan is to make it about the album, meaning we're having a lot of conversations, none of which are finalized. But essentially, somewhere in the week or less period before the album is actually available for sale, we make it so that everybody can hear the album and they decide on their own whether or not they think it's a worthy work. So we're not sending out copies for review. We're not trying to sell the album off of one song. We believe that the album in totality will be significant enough that people will be motivated to want to own it. If you want the marketing campaign, that is essentially it in a nutshell. We believe so much in this album that we're willing to believe if somebody sits down and listens to it, it's 60 minutes and 6 seconds long, or 9 seconds long, I think. You give it that 1 hour, and you're going to walk away, and you're going to say, I believe in what he's doing, I believe in what they're doing, and I want to be a part of it. And I have, and as history dictates, if an album's really, really good, people want to buy it. We have put our whole heart into that idea. There's no tricks. It will be strictly that. Now, we might do it in some interesting and creative ways. We're exploring that. But that is in a nutshell. We believe that when people hear the album, they will change their minds about how they perceive the Pumpkins 2012. I did an interview the other day for Kerrang, and the guy says, it sounds like you're putting a lot of faith out there in this. And I said, that's exactly my point. Because he asked me the question. He said, why are you not sending it out for review? And I said, I am not putting this album in that crowd's hands because that crowd is not invested in whether or not I'm an artist or whether or not the Pumpkins legacy matters or not. I do know that Smashing Pumpkins fans will respond if they believe in what what I'm doing. They did before, and they will again if I've done a good job. And I say that as a producer, not as the artist, because my band was fantastic on this record. And that's one of the best compliments I've gotten on the record, is people saying, wow, you can really hear the band. That's really nice, because, you know, reputation is that's an impossibility. So feel good about all those things, and that's sort of the model.
So far, not very many tour dates have been released, and a couple people have been wondering, with it that seeming to come so soon, how long it might be or when it might be that you guys might be on tour.
There's some talk that we would start official, because, I mean, we're doing these couple festival dates. Mm-hmm. Official Oceania dates, I think, we're looking somewhere in the July range. We feel strongly that the album needs to come out and be out a little bit before we start playing shows.
Are these shows that you plan on doing, are you planning on doing non-festival shows in Europe and in the States and elsewhere?
I think a lot of it's going to depend on you know, the reception to the album. If the reception to the album is as strong as it's been behind the scenes, I think it's going to be a really exciting year as we go out and play the album. You know, the plan is to go out and play the album in the first half of the show in sequence. And not, as people know, I think I told you, Sean Evans, who most recently has been working with Roger Waters on The Wall, which if anybody's seen was incredible, and I feel very, very blessed to be working with Sean. I've seen some of the visuals he's been doing for the show. It's very, very cool. I think it's going to make for a really unique experience. We've been arguing and trying to pull out our hair, not Sean, my world, trying to figure out how to stage this thing, because it's going to be an international show, so we have to figure out how to move all this equipment around. And so we've been going back and forth. We're at the edge of technology of what we want to do on the show, technically, from a visual standpoint. Some people who are sophisticated would know about, like, some of the digital mapping that's now possible. Like, Deadmau5 has been doing some of that stuff. And mostly more in the DJ world, but kind of, it's a way to sort of put graphics across on a bigger scale. The Wall has that, where, you know, they're able to use these high-powered projectors to create some really interesting visuals. We're kind of working with, but on the cutting edge of that technology, so stuff that's not even been used yet. So all those things we have, all those things to come together. So if you can read what I'm saying between the lines, we're planning on a big show. But if you're planning on a big show, enough people need to come. If the reaction, unfortunately, to the album was, let's say, not as positive as we hope it would be, then that's going to be difficult to stage that kind of show for the same level of crowd that we've been playing for the past few years. So everything's got to come together, you know, and I don't think it's a perfect storm. It just needs to move forward. If anybody wants a comparison, I mean, there was a time in Gish where we were playing to certain level crowds, and Siamese, we were playing to certain level crowds, and Melancholy, we were playing. We need to be in a progressive mode, is what I'm saying. Yeah. And rock and roll is very momentum-based, and so if we're moving in the right direction, I think a lot of people will rally around us. I think, true fans, which I consider you one of those people, because you've been there the whole journey since we came back in 2007, you've noted the progress. A lot of it's subtle, but some of the best compliments I've gotten behind the scenes are fans who are real fans. They know the catalog. They know my work. They know my writing. They give me that look like, I can see you dialing it in now. And I think the last few tours have indicated that something was happening within the band. Well, that's translated now to the record. But at the end of the day, if that has to translate, now that process is, we've made this big step. That energy needs to come back at us. If it does, well, you know what happens. The balloon starts to go up and everything starts to rock harder. If it stays the same, or let's say there's an unforeseen set of circumstances, like the world goes, you know, to World War III, you know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong that are out of all of our control.
And with the Oceania, when it's released and everybody's going to hear it, that will then determine the tour?
No, I think you're being overly simplistic. I think the fans that are in the know, from the first Tiergarten song that came out to the 10th or whatever, and the touring, the fans that are in know see that the band's sort of dialing it in. And there's been really, I mean, if people remember back to the last set we were playing last year, that was a fairly challenging set. But the response to the band, the set, was very, very positive. And believe me, that translates back up into the managers, the agents. We started getting better offers. Promoters were promoting the band better again. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that happens when people can feel that something is happening. Okay, so that needs to continue. If we continue to be in a progressive mode, it doesn't mean we have to start selling out, you know, the Megadome tomorrow. It only means the arrow needs to continue to point upwards. As long as the arrow continues to point upwards, we can continue to make more plans.
With your busy schedule, are you even writing music for still, or have you just been too busy with these reissues?
No, I haven't written anything since the end of the album. I've been 100% on the book. The book is so full on. I mean, I worked on the book a lot last year. I wrote some of the book, or at least worked on writing the book last year while I was writing the album. And even during the album sessions, I was getting up early and working on the book about an hour and a half every morning. At this point, I'm working anywhere from 4 to 6 hours a day on the book. If anybody wants to understand the drain of it, it's like taking a test or something. It's like 4 to 6 hours of that level of concentration. You're really tired afterwards. My brain is like just so, you know, going to work on the reissue stuff is fine. It's very passive. I sit there. I like it. I don't like it. But try to generate more music. And soon we're going to start rehearsing, you know, both for the Oceania touring coming up and the festival shows in Europe. And so that's going to be really interesting because I'm going to be trying to write the book during the day and then rehearse with the band at night. So that's it's challenging.
And then you got your tea house coming up here soon.
Yeah.
And Resistance Pro is an ongoing thing that you'll be writing storylines for.
Yeah. Yeah, but those are all labors of love. Those are fun projects. You know, there's a business side to them, obviously, but that's fun. That's been stuff that keeps my mind off of, keeps me happy. When I'm in music world, I'm a little happier if I got other stuff to do. I mean, I've been full on in music world now like 25-something years. It helps to, you know, just like anything, it helps to take little vacations and do other things. I feel like when I come back to music world, I'm really fresh and really, my energy's in the right place. Because I think for a lot of years, I felt that music was taking away too much from my life, and I think I took it out passive-aggressively on my music, which is, of course, immature, but that's just what I did. And I think music is one of those things you need to completely commit yourself if you're going to do it.
Then to wrap this up, because, man, you know what, when you called, I thought, okay, probably a 30-minute thing. I knew how busy you were, and I want to let you know just how much I appreciate you taking the time, especially the fans will appreciate this, to hear about the project. But my last question for you, how happy are you today versus even the recent past, I mean, with where you are today?
I think I'm happier. I'm not exactly where I want to be. I don't think it's any secret that I don't have any kids, and I think that's something that I've not been able to completely work out in my personal life, and I think that's, you know, that's probably one of my great disappointments in life. That said, I'm lucky I have, you know, beautiful dogs and cats and great friends and great love in my life. I feel really good about being in the band. In many ways, I've gotten a second chance. You know, there are those days that are sad that, you know, the original lineup didn't last the way I would have liked it to, that the relationships aren't what I would have hoped they would have been at this point in our life, even if we weren't working together. You know, there are sorrows, and there are things that go with just being in the position of even having to constantly connect with the Smashing Pumpkins energy, which is, you know, it's like a Linus from the Peanuts. You know, it's like a rolling ball of like, one day it's about the past, one day it's about the future, one day it's about the present. You know, there's sort of no way to approach Smashing Pumpkins because of the different eras, the different approaches. I know today you put up the Adore documentary stuff, which I'd never even seen. So I watched some of that, and I mean, it's really weird. I mean, I don't even remember saying that stuff. And, you know, obviously I'm younger. I look a little different, and I look very depressed in the interviews, and I'm watching this, and it's like, it's a part of my life I barely remember. Being in Smashing Pumpkins world is at times a mixed blessing, but overall, I'm so proud of the band I'm in right now. I don't really care what it's called. And for the jerk that goes, well, why don't you call it something different? I think it should be called Smashing Pumpkins in the weirdest way. I think Smashing Pumpkins was always about sort of rubbing people the wrong way. And in a weird way, being in the Smashing Pumpkins continues to rub people the wrong way. God knows why. But I'm proud that we continue as a group to push the boundary, to push the technological boundary, to push the musical legacy, to continue to bring the music to a new generation, which anybody who's 30 and older that's been a fan should never overlook. That's the best part of rock and roll, is the 19-year-old that doesn't care about any of that stuff and discovers Pisces Iscariot or something, and then suddenly they're into it. It's like, we've all had that moment. You know, I had that moment with the Doors in the 80s, you know. I mean, I knew the Doors, but suddenly I was totally into the Doors, and the Doors hadn't been a band for 15 years. Well, since then, the Doors reformed with Ian Astbury as the lead singer, and you know, a lot of people went and saw them play, and people got to reinvest in the music. I just think music is always about being in the present. I love the past, and I'm talking about my past. I'm talking, I love to engage in Bob Dylan's past or John Lennon's past. I love all that stuff, and I'm grateful for fans that continue to find new energy in the past or the present, or they're excited about the future. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, if I read one more thing where the press minimizes who the band is, and I mean Nicole and Jeff and Mike, I just think that is so incredibly offensive. They're really special people because they do really love the band. And when I say the band, I mean the band that we all grew up in, meaning James Darcy, Jimmy and James, you know. What are James Darcy? I said James twice. He's so great, I had to say his name twice. I mean, they all grew up fans, and they really love the band, and they're very honored to be in the band. And this idea that they're rent-a musicians or nobodies, or I just think that is just the most offensive thing, because they really, really care. They really care, and they're prideful, and they're great musicians, and they really want to take the band forward into the 21st century. And I think that part of the story is so easily overlooked in the Billy drama and the past drama. I think that's the part that's going to change with Oceania, because no matter what you call it, this is a very, very good band, and hopefully one day will be a great band, and hopefully Oceania will be the first real chapter of that. I'm hopeful and grateful to even have the opportunity that there are still so many people out there that just want to be a part of what it is that the band means. And as you know, as a fan, and many people know, there is no one way to look at this band. The good comes with the bad, and the crazy comes with the silly. You know, it's all one big ball. And I'm happy to still be in the middle of that. And I think that part will come through when people hear the album. You know, we've been waiting patiently for people to hear the album, and we hope that they feel as strongly about it as we do. Fans are going to decide whether it's not or it's important, and so we await that verdict.
Thank you very much, Billy, for this interview. It was great.
Okay, God bless. Take care.